And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West. The most haunted city in the country. Well, we've got another exciting week underway. And it's an interesting world outside. I saw about a quarter of the cars I normally see this morning. Well, I've got some more strange crimes to talk about. Well, now DNA has come a long way since the 1980s and early 90s. And two of the major cases that helped push it forward came from 87 and 89. The first one was the West Virginia Supreme Court ruling that DNA evidence could be used in a trial. It was a rape case, giving the use of DNA evidence in the courtroom its first major legal precedent. And then in 1989, Gary Dotson out of Chicago became the first person in history to have a conviction overturned through the use of DNA testing. It was an interesting case. Dotson had been convicted in 1979 of the violent rape of a 16-year-old girl and sentenced to 25 to 50 years in prison. And 6 years into his sentence, the 16-year-old victim, who is now 22, admitted she made the whole thing up. It seems that earlier that day, she had had sex with her boyfriend for the first time and was afraid she was pregnant. So by claiming that she had been raped, she'd get out of any parental punishment. But even with that recanting, it took another 4 years and DNA evidence proving the semen taken from the girl's underwear was her boyfriend's, not Dotson's, for Dotson to get exonerated. See, that's one of the problems with impressionable youth. They think if you accuse somebody of something, then you can later just let the whole thing blow over. But it doesn't work that way. Dotson spent 10 years of his life behind bars for something he didn't do. You know, between setting the legal precedent and demonstrating the immense potential that DNA testing had within the criminal justice system, these two cases actually set the course for the development of what's known as forensic science. Now, Charles Dutton was an actor, had a recurring role on House. He played the father, Dr. Foreman. In 1967, a 16-year-old Dutton killed a man in a knife fight and served time for manslaughter. Caught with a deadly weapon while on parole, he went back to prison. He attacked a guard and got more time added to his sentence. While in solitary confinement for refusing a work assignment, he read a book of plays from the prison library. He credits reading Day of Absence by Douglas Turner Ward for inspiring him to turn his life around. He got paroled in 1976, acted in local theater, got a college degree, and won admission to the Yale Drama School. That led to a career on Broadway, in film, on TV. He has said to anybody who'll listen, I consider myself a living testament to the power of the arts. Then, of course, there's Tim Allen, stand-up comedian, film actor, star of Home Improvement. 1978, he was arrested for drug trafficking. He tried to sell 1.4 pounds of cocaine to an undercover cop. You can never find a cop when you need one, but if you go to sell drugs, chances are the guy you're selling to, or the woman, is an undercover cop. And that got him sent away for life. But he copped a plea and testified against other drug dealers, so he served a little over 2 years in federal prison. While awaiting sentencing, he made his first appearance as a stand-up comedian at the Comedy Castle in Detroit. He said later the judge suggested I get my act together, and I took him seriously. And apparently he's been honing that act ever since. Well, you know, these days it seems like people sue each other over practically anything. Now, here are some unusual legal battles. The plaintiff was named Toshi Van Blitter. The defendant was Harris Casino. Well, after losing $350,000 playing blackjack, Van Blitter decided to sue the Las Vegas casino. She filed to have her debts canceled, claiming Harris was negligent. They should have told her she was an incompetent blackjack player. Well, in this particular case, just like at the casino, the gamble didn't pay off. Federal judge dismissed her claim. Then we have Timothy Ray Anderson. He was an armed robber. He sued John Hobson, a security guard at a McDonald's restaurant. Well, you see, Anderson was robbing a McDonald's at gunpoint, and Hobson ordered him to drop the weapon. Anderson spun around, aiming his gun at Hobson, but Hobson shot first, hitting Anderson in the stomach. Well, Anderson was subsequently convicted of armed robbery and sentenced to 15 years. Anderson then, with the help of an ambulance chaser, sued Hobson, the firm Hobson worked for, and the owner of the McDonald's, claiming excessive force was used against him. His argument was, the mere fact you're holding up a McDonald's with a gun doesn't mean you give up your right to be protected from somebody who wants to shoot you. And the attorney seriously made that argument. Well, the case was thrown out of court. And Anderson was told to just serve his time like a good criminal. And there was another case that took place in Alabama, of all places. And the plaintiff who was suing the police officer that arrested him had been convicted of beating an old man in a wheelchair to steal his money. And every so often during the trial, the plaintiff would jump up and scream, "It was police brutality, they beat me." Finally, the judge had enough. He got up, took off his robe, stepped down to the counsel table, asked the plaintiff to stand up, and proceeded to beat the bejesus out of him right there in the courtroom. Bailiff was just stunned. Finally, the judge finished, put on his robe, sat back down, and said, "Now, had the police done that to you that I just did, I would agree it was police brutality, but they didn't. And since I also am going to be handling the criminal case against you, I'm dismissing this case. And in the next case, if you say one word, I'll double whatever sentence I was going to give. And you will go serve that sentence like a good criminal." I kid you not, that was an actual case out of Alabama. Now, they got different ways of dealing with things in Alabama. They'll shoot you. Now, how about an open and shut case? One night in July of 2009, 18-year-old Daniel Barr of Strasburg, Pennsylvania, and a bunch of his friends were driving around, decided it'd be fun to throw eggs at a police car. Well, they found a parked cruiser and proceeded to throw eggs at it. Might have gotten away with it. But they chose a police car that was occupied by a police officer who was sitting kind of down in his seat because he was reading some paperwork. They didn't see him there. Well, he jumped out and they didn't get away fast enough. In January 2008, a 53-year-old man, his 20-year-old accomplice, set out to rob the Vernon, British Columbia branch of CIBC Bank. The older man went into the bank to commit the actual robbery while the younger man stayed in the getaway car listening to the radio. Well, when the older man came back with the stolen money, the car wouldn't start. The guy listening to the radio had run the battery down. Well, they got out of the car and ran down the street, but got arrested a few minutes later. And why, you might ask, were the police so quick to respond? Well, this particular branch of CIBC Bank is located next door to the police station. Duh. Well, 33-year-old Sean Lester stormed into a Charleston, West Virginia convenience store, filled up a cup at the soda fountain, demanded all the money in the register, claiming he had a gun. Well, before the clerk could get the money out of the register, Lester changed his mind and decided not to go through with the robbery. So he started to walk out of the store with his drink, and the clerk told Lester he had to pay for the drink, and he did with his debit card. And even though he signed the receipt, John Doe, and didn't steal any money, the police traced the debit card and arrested Lester at his home for the attempted robbery. Please. Well, one day in June 2009, an employee at Ziggy's, a hardware store in Spokane, Washington, found a plastic bag filled with small crystallized rocks on the floor near the checkout. And thinking it was crystal meth, the employee called the police. Well, before the police got there, 34-year-old Christopher Wilson walked in and asked if anybody found a bag of crystal meth he thought he might have lost in the store. Well, the employee lied and told him they hadn't, so Wilson left his name and phone number just in case the drugs did turn up. And then Wilson went home, where the police arrested him a few minutes later. You just can't trust anybody these days. Then in 2009, a Massachusetts man showed up at a police station and asked to have a pair of handcuffs removed. Earlier that day, the man's sister, who had put the cuffs on him as a joke, lost the key. On a whim, the police ran his name through their computer and discovered he had several outstanding warrants. So they gave him a brand new pair of handcuffs. They did take the pair off that was on him, but they gave him others. Well, sometimes helpful politicians seem to personally invest in positive foreign relations. In 1978, two wealthy Arab sheikhs started inviting U.S. government officials to meetings. The purpose of the meetings, the sheikhs had a ton of money and they wanted them to help make investments in the U.S. Well, several government officials happily took the sheikhs' money and invested it in their own pockets in exchange for helping secure purchases of casinos, mining companies, and a number of other American businesses. Well, the sheiks weren't actually sheiks. They're actually undercover FBI agents. All part of the agency's Abscam operation. And that name came from Abdul, the name of the fictitious company the sheiks owned, and Scam, Abscam. And the government officials, there were 8 members of Congress, 5 members of the House of Representatives went to federal prison. So did Senator Harrison Williams of the New Jersey, who was videotaped promising the sheiks he'd help him get contracts to open a titanium mine in exchange for shares in the company. Williams remains one of only 2 U.S. senators in history who went to prison for crimes committed while in office. Well, sometimes you just can't even trust the criminals. Well, a 2008 report by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police said that gang members involved in international drug smuggling had infiltrated airports in major cities around the country, and most of them were working as baggage handlers. Well, Canada's Criminal Intelligence Service estimates more than 11,000 Canadians are members of street gangs. More than 130 gangs are based in Vancouver alone, vying for drug business estimated to be worth more than $6 billion a year. In the late 1990s, Toronto police arrested 4 members of the Spadina Girls, a short-lived all-female gang led by a 16-year-old girl. The gang charged other students for protection, and the arrest came after gang members brutally assaulted a fellow student at a billiard hall. Well, a much more dangerous all-female gang formed in recent years. It's called the Indian Posse Girls, an offshoot of Indian Posse. They believed to be in control of the sex trade in Winnipeg and Edmonton. You always got somebody who comes up with a better idea how to do things. Well, in 1913, thousands of people with the last name Drake got a letter from the Sir Francis Drake Association, an organization founded for the purpose of settling the estate of the legendary British buccaneer who had died 300 years before. Any Drake descendant who wanted a share of the estate was welcome to apply. All they had to do was contribute toward the $2,500 a week legal expenses needed to pursue the case. There was a fighter in the way, and any Drake descendant who hesitated risked being cut out entirely of the fortune left by Sir Francis Drake. Well, this was a scam, kind of like the Nigerian Prince scam, and it was the work of Iowa con man Oscar Merrill Hartzell. got the idea for his version after his mother was conned out of several thousand dollars in another Drake estate scam. When he tracked down the crooks who had swindled her and realized how much money they were making, he decided rather than call the police, he'd keep quiet and launch his own. Using the money he'd recovered for his mother, he promptly sent out letters to more than 20,000 folks with the last name of Drake. Well, by the time the feds caught up with him 20 years later, he had swindled an estimated 70,000 people out of more than $2 million. Rather than admit they'd been duped, many of the victims donated an additional $350,000 towards his legal defense. He was convicted of mail fraud and sentenced to 10 years in federal prison. A few years later, he was transferred to a mental institution where he died in 1943, or at least that is the story. There are those that think he got away and moved to Nigeria and set himself up as a Nigerian prince. Well, in Texas, a lot of things are unusual, I guess you could say. And in Texas, cheerleading is a deadly serious business. Let's talk about the Texas cheerleader mom. Her name was Wanda Holloway. 1991, lived in Houston, worked as a secretary, and played the piano for her church. Well, she tried to hire a hitman to kill the mother of a rival cheerleader at her daughter's middle school. You see, Wanda really, really wanted her daughter, Shayna Harper, to be a cheerleader. And Shayna had failed to make the cheerleading squad because of improper campaigning. Her mother had given away pencils and rulers that had Shayna's name on them to promote her, which was apparently a big no-no, so she wound up being disqualified. Well, Wanda wanted to give her daughter an extra edge up the next year, but not by helping her with a routine. Now, Wanda decided to murder their neighbor, Werner Heath, whose daughter, Amber, was also trying to make the cheerleader squad. Wanda thought Amber would be so distraught at the death of her mother, she wouldn't be able to cheer. And that would open the door for her own daughter to make the team. Well, before Werner Heath got bumped off, the police found out and arrested Wanda. Some folks just don't have a sense of humor. You see, because Wanda Holloway chose her co-conspirators poorly, the whole thing fell apart. The thrice-married Holloway approached her former brother-in-law, Terry Harper, about finding somebody to act as a hitman. And Harper told the authorities about Holloway's ambitions. And then he went to talk with her wearing a wire, which shows you just can't trust relatives. Now, Holloway toyed with the idea of killing both Verna and Amber Heath, but Harper told her it would cost $7,500 each, so she decided to go the more economical way of bumping off only the mother, which was going to be offered to her at a bargain price of only $2,500. Holloway said, and this is a direct quote from the tape, "Maybe I should go with the mother. The kid, she can just be screwed with the murder. Maybe mess with her mind." Later, Holloway met with her hitman, who was actually an undercover cop, and handed over a pair of diamond earrings in payment, which was sufficient to make the charge of solicitation for capital murder. Well, she went on trial in 1991, was convicted, and sentenced to 15 years in jail. But it was a little more unusual than that. A mistrial was declared when it was discovered that one of the jurors were improperly impaneled. Seems he was on probation for cocaine possession, which is apparently enough to get you out of the jury pool in Texas. 1996, she pled no contest to solicitation of capital murder and got 10 years in prison. But just 6 months after she went to the slammer, she got released on probation. So, did her daughter make the cheerleading team? No. But Amber Heath, the daughter of the woman she wanted to kill, was on the cheerleading squad all through high school. Well, you gotta wonder. Well, but remember the quote off the TV show, the first rule about Fight Club, you don't talk about Fight Club? Well, in the 1999 movie Fight Club, Tyler Durden, Brad Pitt, runs an underground club where men have bloody fist fights with each other. They belong to Project Mayhem, a terrorist cell that blows up symbols of corporate America, including in one scene a Starbucks coffee shop. And that film has gained a huge cult following. One of the biggest fans was 17-year-old Kyle Shaw, who maintained he actually wanted to be Tyler Durden. Well, in 2009, Shaw started his own fight club in New York City. But fighting his fellow teenagers wasn't enough. So following the model of Project Mayhem, he built a crude homemade bomb and set it off in front of a Starbucks in the middle of the night, destroying an outdoor bench. Well, ignoring the first rule of Fight Club, which is you don't talk about Fight Club, and I guess if you're doing bombing, you don't talk about that either, Shaw bragged about it to his friends, one of whom called the cops. Coincidentally, the jail that Shaw went to had its own version of a Fight Club called the Program. While he was on a payphone, a much larger inmate walked up and hit him in the face, gave him a black eye for his appearance in court the next day. You just can't get good help these days. Well, the verdict is in. These are actually said word for word in a court of law. The judge. I know you, don't I? Defendant. Yes. Judge. All right, how do I know you? Defendant. Do I have to tell you? Judge. Of course, you might be obstructing justice not to tell me. Defendant. Okay, I was your bookie. Duh. Judge. Please identify yourself for the record. Defendant, Colonel Ebenezer Jackson. Judge, what does the colonel stand for? Defendant, well, it's kind of like the honorable in front of your name. Not a damn thing. Duh. Okay, next case. Judge, you're charged with habitual drunkenness. Have you anything to say in your defense? Defendant, habitual thirstiness. Plaintiff's lawyer. What doctor treated you for injuries you sustained while at work? Plaintiff, Dr. J. Plaintiff's lawyer. What kind of physician is Dr. J? Plaintiff, well, I'm not sure, but I remember you said he was a good plaintiff's doctor. Defendant, if I called you a son of a bitch, what would you do? Judge, I'd hold you in contempt and assess an additional 5 days in jail. Defendant, what if I thought you were a son of a bitch? Judge, I can't do a thing about that. There's no law against thinking. Defendant, in that case, I think you're a son of a bitch. Well, sometimes folks don't know when they're well enough off. 2012, Michelle Chapman reported to police her family members had been trolling her online, relentlessly bombarding her social media with vile, diminishing comments. When police investigated and discovered that Michelle had set up catfish accounts and posted the insults on her real account herself. And she was the first person in Britain to be arrested for trolling herself. Well, here's a possible name for a TV show. Who wants to sue a billionaire? Answer, everybody. Plaintiff, Hollywood producer Steve Bing. The defendant, movie mogul, studio mogul Kurt Kerkorian. The lawsuit, Kerkorian's ex-wife, Lisa Bonder, sued for $320,000 a month in child support for their 4-year-old daughter. Billionaire Kerkorian claimed he couldn't possibly be the father. He was sterile. He also said he had proof the real father was Bonder's ex-boyfriend, multimillionaire Steve Bing. His private detectives had collected DNA evidence. They went through Bing's garbage and found some used dental floss. Probability that Bing's the dad is 99.993%. Bing sued for an invasion of privacy, asking a staggering $1 billion in damages. Verdict. They settled out of court, and the suit was dropped. Well, here's a quote from O.J. Simpson. I always thought I'd been pretty good with people, and I basically have spent a conflict-free life, you know. The mere fact he was accused of murdering some folks hurt his feelings. There's no evidence, of course, that he actually did it, because he would, in fact, the court said he didn't do it. Well, when you're leading a life of crime, GPS isn't quite as nifty as it is for the rest of us. 2009, 22-year-old Jeremiah Gillum stole an Xbox from a home in an affluent section of Westchester County, in New York, just north of New York City. Took it to his grandmother's apartment in the Bronx and decided to play a game. But to do so, Gillum had to log on to the victim's Xbox Live account. And that made it easy for police to track down the IP address that led him straight to grandma's. When they showed up to question Gillum, they found 50 other stolen gadgets and in one swoop solved dozens of unsolved burglaries in Westchester County. I guess GPS means great policing service. Well, police sirens blared behind William Bolin as he drove a car full of stolen contraband through Steens, Mississippi. He didn't know how the police had tracked him down, but figured one of the stolen items had a GPS device, so he started throwing stuff out of the car. Purses, wallets, guns, but he couldn't elude the police, who were keeping a safe distance. Well, if he'd only thrown away the stolen cell phone, he might have gotten away, but he kept it. This is one of the few cases where somebody stole a cell phone with GPS, and all his movements led us right to him, according to police investigator Tony Cooper. It's always that last item. Well, forensic science, and by extension, the criminal justice system's come a long way with the assistance of technology. 1901, human blood groups are identified and described by Austrian doctor Karl Landsteiner, who subsequently codified his discoveries into the blood types we know today. Now, this discovery was useful in the field of forensic as well as in medicine in general, and it lands Landsteiner a Nobel Prize in 1930. 1910, Rosella Rousseau confesses to the murder of Germaine Bichon. Why? Because her hairs match the hairs at the crime scene, a technique pioneered by Victor Balthazard, a professor of forensic medicine at the Sorbonne. That same year, another French professor of forensic medicine, Edmond Locard, helps create the first police crime lab. First crime lab in the U.S. wasn't founded until 1925 by LAPD Police Chief August Vollmer. 1921, a portable polygraph was invented. 1923, polygraph testimonies ruled inadmissible in U.S. courts. Sometimes you just can't win. 1925, blood is not the only bodily fluid you can type, suggested Japanese scientist K.I. Yoshida, as he undertook studies to determine serological isoantibodies and other bodily fluids. Turns out he was right. 1960, an arsonist's job gets harder as gas chromatography is used for the first time in a lab to identify specific petroleum products. 1977, Japanese forensic scientist Fushio Matsumura notices fingerprints popping up as he prepares a slide for examination and tells his friend Masato Soba. Soba uses this information to help develop the first process to raise latent prints with cyanoacrylic, or as more commonly known, super glue. Yep, super glue. What you've seen on TV actually works, provided you don't get your hand stuck to your face. And now you know why not to get it on your fingers. 1984 was an iconic year for the successful DNA profiling test created by Britain's Sir Alec Jeffreys. 1986, Jeffreys uses his DNA profiling method to help convict the ominously named Colin Pitchfork for murder. Interestingly enough, in this same case, DNA is used to clear another man accused of the crime. 1987, DNA profiling makes its debut in the U.S. and nails Tommy Lee Andrews for a number of sexual assaults in Orlando, Florida. But in that same year, the admissibility of DNA profiling is challenged in another case, New York versus Castro. In this particular case, the defendant's accused of murder. And it set the stage for many years of back-and-forth argument on the standards and practices of the labs that perform the DNA testing. 1986, in Tennessee, a man named Paul Ware is accused of murder, but the only physical evidence is a few hairs. Investigators use these hairs to extract DNA from mitochondria, a small structure within human cells. It was the first use of mitochondria DNA to convict somebody of a crime. Well, let's talk about a case where everybody was happy to find out the whole thing was a hoax. A woman put a bandana over her face and then posted a video on an internet site in January 2010 in which she claimed she had HIV/AIDS. and that she had infected more than 500 men in Detroit, Michigan with the disease. And she went on to say she planned to infect more men because she wanted to destroy the world. Well, within a few days, more than 500,000 people had watched that video. Detroit police were able to quickly identify the woman, Jackie Braxton, of 23, a Detroit adult film actress. After she was arrested, she admitted she had made the video, but said it was a hoax. And then she volunteered to take an HIV test, and it came back negative. Says she started the hoax to raise awareness about AIDS. Police decided she probably had not committed a crime. Scared the hell out of a lot of people, though. Well, Braxton did apparently raise awareness in Detroit. Michael McElrath, a spokesman for the city's health department, said after the video went viral, the number of men who went to clinics for HIV testing in Detroit more than doubled. Sometimes. Well, even the floor of the Senate's been the scene of some unruly behavior. May 22nd, 1856, South Carolina Senator Andrew Butler was ridiculed on the Senate floor by anti-slavery advocate Charles Sumner of Massachusetts during the debate of whether Kansas should be admitted to the Union as a slave state or a free state. During his speech entitled The Crime Against Kansas, Sumner accused Butler of leading the effort to spread slavery to Kansas. For Butler, he said, had taken a mistress who, though ugly to others, is always lovely to him. And I mean the harlot, slavery. Well, Butler's response wasn't recorded, but by all accounts, Sumner concluded his speech and the day's session continued. Meanwhile, in the House of Representatives, Butler's cousin, Congressman Brooks, was preparing his own response to what he considered a grievous slander against a kinsman and fellow Southerner. Sumner was sitting at his desk, putting stamps on copies of his speech to send to constituents. Slamming his metal-tipped cane onto Sumner's head, Brooks proceeded to beat the man viciously about the head and shoulders. Then he turned on his heels and walked out. Well, to their partisans, each man became an instant hero. The stunned and bloodied Sumner was carried away by friends. It took him months to recover from his wounds, but he returned to the Senate and served another 18 years. Brooks, for his part, survived a Senate censure vote and was even reelected to office, but died 6 months later at the age of 37. There's no record as to what killed him. Let's talk about the Son of Sam. You know, a lot of people wonder how he got his nickname. David Berkowitz murdered six people, wounded several others, and committed arson around New York City in 1976 and 1977. He became known to the press as the .44 caliber killer after the weapon he used in most of his attacks. In April of 77, Berkowitz left a letter at the scene of a double murder in the Bronx, and a month later sent another letter to New York Daily News columnist Jimmy Breslin. In both letters, he referred to himself as the Son of Sam, explaining that Sam was an evil spirit that compelled him to kill. He said, "Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill," commands Father Sam. Berkowitz later said the Sam was a demon that possessed his neighbor's dog, and the dog talked to him. Well, police eventually released that information to the press, and the rest, of course, is serial killer history. Berkowitz was captured in August of 77. His first words to police, "You got me. What took you so long?" He's now serving 25 years to life for each murder. Well, in 1987, Berkowitz became a born-again Christian in prison. And on his personal website, oh yes, he has one, it's reportedly administered with the help of friends outside the prison. He says he no longer wants to be known as the Son of Sam, but now he wants to be known as the Son of Hope. Maybe he knows Bill Clinton. He was the man from Hope. Well, how cold was it during the January 2014 polar vortex? It was so cold the Chicago Zoo had to put its polar bears and penguins inside. And in Kentucky, it was so cold that an escaped prisoner decided to go back to prison just so he could warm up. The ex-con named Robert Vick had run away from the minimum security Blackburn Correctional Complex, where he was serving a 6-year sentence for burglary and possession of a forged instrument. But he picked a bad day to escape. The temperature in Lexington that day was only 3 degrees Fahrenheit, and the wind chill made it seem like minus 17. Now, we all know Kentuckians aren't used to those kinds of temperatures. So Vic, who had no money on him, spent the night in an abandoned house and went to a motel the next day, but not to check in. He walked in and told the desk clerk to call the police. He said, I don't think the police even believed me. I had to call again. See, Victor was scheduled to go before the parole board in only 2 months. Instead, he got another 5 years tacked onto his sentence for the escape. Well, if you remember the TV show The Fugitive with David Janssen, I met him and his mother at an event in California. Very nice man. He died not too long after that. Director Roy Huggins denied he based his movie The Fugitive on a true story, but the events in the series are suspiciously close to the murder trial of Sam Shepard. One July morning in 1954, Shepard called police to tell them he'd been attacked by a bushy-haired man who broke into his Cleveland home. The intruder knocked the doctor unconscious, and when Shepard came to, he discovered his pregnant wife, Marilyn, had been murdered. Well, the shocked public was sympathetic, but the police were suspicious. They wondered why Shepard couldn't find a T-shirt he'd worn that night. They said the crime scene didn't look like a typical burglary. It looked staged. And nobody could find the murder weapon or the bushy-haired intruder. Public feeling turned against Shepard after he admitted to an adulterous affair that he had previously denied. Eventually, he was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. Well, while Shepard was serving time for the murder, police arrested a thief in possession of Marilyn's wedding ring. The suspect, a man named Richard Eberling, admitted he'd burgled the home of Marilyn's sister-in-law, who inherited the ring after Marilyn's death. And Eberling also said he'd worked on Marilyn's home days before her murder, and he cut his finger while he was there. Well, police released Eberling after he passed a lie detector test that he didn't kill Marilyn. Now, there is evidence that Marilyn herself was having an affair with the neighbor. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court was reviewing prejudicial press coverage against Shepard. It was a carnival the judge never tried to control. In 1966, the Supreme Court granted Shepard a new trial, and at that second trial, he was acquitted. Well, to show you how times have changed, in 1907, Australian swimming star Annette Kellerman wore a one-piece bathing suit that revealed her knees and exposed her elbows. Police arrested her for indecent exposure. Guess they didn't like knees and elbows. Well, let's talk about the case of mistaken identity. Eric Nordman, 35, was a homeless man in California. In 2003, Nordman was walking down the street when two police officers stopped him. They brought him to the station and took his mugshot, and then he got released. A few weeks later, as he walked out of a store, the police were waiting for him. They cuffed and arrested him. The charge this time was he assaulted three 11-year-old girls. A few days earlier, the police claimed they were attacked by a homeless man on the way home from school, but they got away. Now, Nordman's disheveled appearance matched their description, and two of the three girls identified him in a photo lineup. Well, bail was set at $50,000, even though Nordman didn't even have $50,000, so he was forced to remain in jail until his trial began 8 months later. At the trial, one of the accusers took the stand and said he started choking me, I couldn't breathe, and felt like I was going to black out. Nordman told his lawyer if he was convicted, he'd kill himself or he'd go to prison. Following day, Nordman was brought back to court, and the judge said all charges had been dismissed. The girl apologized and explained and made up the story because they got home late from school that day and didn't want to get in trouble. So all three girls got arrested for making a false accusation. Well, November 10, 2017 turned out to be quite a day for Chandra Borelli. That morning, the 33-year-old Berkshire, Massachusetts woman stole a car, got caught, got arrested, posted bail, and stole another car. And it wasn't even 10 o'clock yet. She was just getting going. While police were looking for the Toyota Highlander she'd driven off with while it was idling, they got a call about a stolen Lexus. When they arrived at the scene where the Lexus had been stolen, they found the abandoned Highlander. Meanwhile, Borelli decided she wanted something classier, so she ditched the Lexus and stole a BMW, her fourth car theft of the day. For Berkshire, that was a record, police said. The officers in pursuit across several jurisdictions at this point finally spotted the stolen Lexus that evening. Well, she took off at speeds over 100 miles an hour and ended up losing control of the car near Duke Sand and Gravel, according to Chester Police Chief Timothy Garner. She didn't crash, but she almost hit a flatbed wrecker this coming back from returning the Highlander she stole earlier in the day. Well, she was eventually caught and sent to jail. And for some reason, the judge decided she was a flight risk and denied her bail. Nobody could understand it. Well, you know, sometimes, according to those that claim to have connections to the other side, so to speak, Conrine seems wind up being haunted. The home in Fall River, Massachusetts, where Lydia Borden is said to have murdered her parents, is a B&B today. That's bed and breakfast for you folks from that have classical educations. You can stay in the same room where Lizzie's stepmom, Abby, was killed. And it looks the same as it did in 1892. Hadn't even been swept yet. Making it even creepier, there's a crime scene photo of Abby's corpse hanging on a wall right next to the spot where she was found. Guests have reported hearing a woman whisper in her ear, seeing a human-shaped indentation in the bed, and even glimpsing a full-bodied apparition of Abby. But the scariest claim is the disembodied, maniacal laughter that many people attribute to Lizzie herself. Now, interestingly enough, there's not ever been any confirmed proof that Lizzie's actually the one that killed her parents. Now, let's talk about the Chelsea Hotel. Sex Pistols lead singer Sid Vicious and his girlfriend Nancy Spungen were living at the trendy New York Hotel in 1978. One night, Sid and Nancy took a lot of drugs and got into a huge fight. When Sid woke up the next morning, Nancy was dead on the bathroom floor, the victim of a stab wound. After giving police conflicting accounts of what happened, Sid was arrested and died of a drug overdose while out on bail. Unable to rest peacefully, Nancy's ghost is said to roam the halls of that hotel to this day. They have yet to say if anybody's seen Sid's ghost. Now, the Beverly Hills, California house where members of the Manson family brutally murdered Sharon Tate's gone. Another house built 30 years after the 1969 killing stands about 200 feet away. The owner, David Oman, insists the ghost of Tate has taken up residence at his house. And his claims have been backed up by such paranormal investigation shows as Ghost Hunters and Ghost Adventures. According to Oman, the geomagnetic energy of his house makes it a containment vessel for spirits. Well, if you're skeptical, you can rent it out for a night and conduct an investigation yourself. Who knows what you'll find? Now, of course, one of the most famous haunted crime scenes is what's known as the Amityville House. See, in 1974, Ronald Butch DeFeo Jr. murdered his family in their Long Island, New York home. A year later, George and Kathleen Lutz moved into the house. 28 days later, they moved out. Among their claims, which spawned a book and a movie series, the horrors of Amityville included green slime coming out of the walls, putrid odors, and a pig-like creature with red eyes, who many believe have gone on to be a member of Congress. Though dogged by claims of a hoax, the Lutches stuck to their story, and DeFeo, who's still in prison, once said voices in the house told him to carry out the murders. There's also a lot of evidence he and his sister, who was quite a looker by all accounts, were getting it on, which may have led to part of the problem. One snowy afternoon in December 2009, about 200 office workers took part in a snowball fight on 14th Street in Washington, D.C. Well, everybody was having a good time till somebody threw a snowball at a Hummer SUV who was driving along the road. The Hummer slid to a halt. A huge, imposing man got out and demanded to know who threw that snowball. When nobody answered, the man pulled a pistol, sending people running in all directions. A few tense moments later, a uniformed police officer arrived and ordered the man to drop his gun. And that's when the gunman identified himself as Detective Mike Baylor. When the danger passed, the crowd started chanting, "You don't bring a gun to a snowball fight." Well, at first, the D.C. Police Department denied that the detective, a 28-year veteran, pulled out his gun. But, as usual, there were a number of cell phone cameras that caught the incident. It made the rounds on YouTube. And in the local news, picked up the story. That's when D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier called Baylor's actions totally inappropriate. She put him on desk duty so he could finish out his time for retirement. Of course, if somebody threw a snowball at me, number one, I'd wonder where in West Texas they got a snowball. And number two, I might be tempted to fight fire with something heavier. Well, do you have what it takes to treat a psychopath? 1968, Elliot Barker, a psychiatrist at the Oak Ridge Hospital for the Criminally Insane in Pendakosweeney, Ontario, thought he could cure psychopaths. His solution? Nude psychotherapy sessions fueled with LSD lasting for 11 days at a time. The patients, all male, volunteered to be placed in a windowless 8-by-10-foot room. Soundproof room had a sink, a toilet, and a one-way mirror in the ceiling. No beds, no privacy. Patients had to sleep on a small rug over a foam mat. Then Dr. Barker went out to procure batches of LSD as well as the approval of the Canadian government. But with no windows and lights on around the clock, patients weren't able to tell day from night. Confusion, disorientation, and confrontations between the men ensued. The psychopaths were encouraged to go to their rawest emotional places, screaming and clawing at the walls and confessing fantasies or forbidden sexual longings. Barker thought his technique would summon the madness so patients could be born again as empathetic human beings. Well, at first, the results looked promising. The tough young prisoners were slowly transforming and seeming to care for each other. Psychopathic murderers were now gentle people. Many were declared cured and set free. On average, 60% of the criminal psychopaths released to the outside world to become repeat offenders. But Dr. Barker's patients, 80% of them became repeat offenders. So the treatment did have success, but in the wrong direction. Well, here's a quote from James Belushi you may find interesting. But if you go over the line, you don't want to get stuck in a Nevada state courtroom. Honestly, because Nevada's been doing a good job of putting California criminals in jail. I mean, we couldn't put OJ in jail, but they did. We couldn't put Paris Hilton in jail, but they did. Sometimes you got to look at the silver lining. A new anti-pornography law couldn't go into effect in Winchester, Indiana, because the editors of the town's only newspaper refused to print the wording of the law on the basis it was itself pornographic. And for a new law to be official, it had to be printed in the newspaper. So the law didn't go into effect. New York State Assemblywoman Nancy Calhoun pled guilty to charges as she harassed her ex-boyfriend in 1999. According to testimony, she burst into his home in the middle of the night, tailgated him in a car, and posed as a cosmetic seller to get his new girlfriend's phone number. What was interesting was Calhoun was the co-sponsor of the state's new anti-stalking legislation. Well, at least she knew what she was talking about, which is unique in as far as legislators is concerned. Well, on October 30th, 2003, Congress released findings of a study that said toy guns don't have any relationship to crime. That same day, the Capitol was locked down for an hour because two workers had brought toy guns to work as part of their Halloween costumes. Duh. Well, in March of 2000, three security guards at the mansion on Turtle Creek, a hotel in Dallas, I've been there, they got great food, responded to a noise complaint about a guest. Dallas Stars goaltender Eddie Balfour was the guest in question. The caller told the guards Balfour had become drunk, angry, and violent, and she feared for her safety. Well, when three guards arrived, attempted to subdue him, Balfour reacted as if they were charging forward on an opposing team. Kicked two of them in the chest and spat in the other's face. Well, thanks to a hefty dose of pepper spray, the guards finally got him under control. And by the time the police arrived, the hockey player's violent rampage had dwindled to pathetic pleading. He said, "If you let me go, I'll give you $1 billion. Well, the police rejected the bribe and placed him in the back of a squad car where he proceeded to throw up over himself and the car. He got a $3,000 fine. Then in 2009, Miami Heat forward Michael Beasley used Twitter to show off a picture of a tattoo he just got. The photo depicted Beasley's back decorated with the tattoo of an angel wings and the words, "Super Cool B-E-A-S. B-E-A-S is his nickname. Also depicted in the photo was a baggie containing a green leafy substance. After a few readers pressed him on it over the next few days, he'd had problems with the NBA and the law over drugs. He closed the Twitter account and checked into a Houston drug treatment facility. That is known as taking the horn by the bulls, I guess. Sonny and Gina Hahn seemed to have it all. Identical twins were co-valedictorians at their San Diego high school. They were beautiful. They were inseparable. Until they had a falling out. Well, in 1996, Gina became convinced Sonny had stolen some of her stuff. And despite Sonny's denials, Gina wouldn't let it go. According to several witnesses, she openly discussed wanting her sister dead. Then one night, Sonny and her roommate, Helen Kim, were in their apartment when two teenage boys pretending to be magazine salesmen barged in and tied up Helen. Sonny hid in her bedroom and called 911. Police arrived just in time to prevent a double homicide. When questioned, the teams had said they were acting on behalf of Gina, who'd orchestrated the crime. Well, Gina was convicted of conspiracy to attempt murder. At her sentencing hearing, she said, through tears, "I'm deeply sorry for everything that's happened," but she didn't confess. She said, "I absolutely had no intention to kill my twin sister." Judge didn't buy it, though, and called Gina a danger to society, particularly her own family. She got the maximum sentence, 26 years to life in prison. She got parole in 2017, but that could still be overturned if she gets out of line again. Well, Robert Louis Stevenson, the writer, fascinated the world with a story called The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And that was inspired by a fellow Scotsman. William Brodie was born into an upright 18th century Edinburgh family and grew up as the model of respectability. He was the deacon of the local chapter of the Masons Guild, as well as the Edinburgh City Councillor. He loved to gamble, though, and in an ongoing relationship with two prostitutes. Inevitably, the gambling debt started to pile up. When his two mistresses began to produce little Brodies, the good deacon found himself in desperate financial straits. Well, in the course of his legitimate daytime activities, he visited his rich clients in their homes. He started making wax impressions of house keys he came across and checking out the houses for items of interest. And he'd come back in the evening to gather up the goods. Teamed up with a locksmith, and together they stole everything they could find that wasn't nailed down, and in some cases, what was nailed down. Well, in contrast to his elegant and cultured cohort, his partner, George Smith, was a small-time crook with few redeeming qualities. When two more local criminals with similar dispositions were recruited into the gang, the undoing of William Brodie began. His most daring heist, an attack on the headquarters of the Scottish Customs and Excise, was plagued with stupid mistakes. Brodie, dressed in black, acting as if he were playing the role of in a pageant, stood guard outside as two other members of the gang made their way inside. Once inside, one of his partners got cold feet, and the usually cool Brodie canceled the job. Well, somebody eventually told authorities that the man behind the raid was none other than the highly respected deacon William Brodie. Well, the police were dispatched to Brodie's apartment, but only so they could officially discount the preposterous suggestion he could be involved. But what they found there has shocked everybody, substantiated the accusations. Skeleton keys, a burglar's black suit, and several pistols were cataloged and taken to headquarters for further examination. Brodie couldn't be found. He'd fled to Holland, intending to set sail for America. But as he boarded the ship, wearing a top hat and tails, he was approached by two Dutch police officers. They escorted him back to dry land and extradited him back to Edinburgh. He seemed completely untroubled by the fate that awaited him, death by hanging. As he stood on the gallows that he himself and his role as city councilor had designed, Brodie offered up his own prayer Then he bravely beckoned for the hangman to perform his task. Well, the night before, he'd rigged his clothes with wire to take the jerk of the rope, because that's usually what breaks the neck. The silver tube he'd stuck down his throat was supposed to prevent his neck from breaking. But the trick failed, and Deacon Brodie breathed his last October 1st, 1788. Well, you know, during the routine cleanups of homeless encampments, police sometimes make strange discoveries. And one of the strangest took place in Santa Ana, California in 2017. While clearing the typical trash, needles, and whatnot from a concrete riverbed, the public works crew ventured into a 6-foot-high spillway tunnel and saw a stash of bicycles. At first, it looked like there were only a few dozen bikes there, but as they investigated further, the tunnel kept going, and so did the bikes. In all, they found more than 1,000 bicycles that were hauled out of the tunnel. Sheriff's Lieutenant Jeff Puckett told the Orange County Register, you know, common sense would usually dictate if you have 1,000 bicycles in a tunnel, some of them probably could be stolen. Maybe. You know, it was Rudy Giuliani who once made the comment, it's about time law enforcement got as organized as organized crime. And he was correct. I met him at an event here. He signed a copy of his book for me. Well, how did New York City, a famous cigar girl, and Edgar Allan Poe combine to create one of the world's first murder mysteries? Well, in 1841, the body of 21-year-old Mary Cecilia Rogers was found floating in the Hudson River near Hoboken, New Jersey. Now, the discovery shocked everybody, not just because the body was battered beyond recognition, but because Rogers was famous in New York City. One of America's first celebrities, she was nicknamed the Beautiful Cigar Girl. Until shortly before her death, she worked at a huge tobacco and cigar shop on Broadway. And according to legend, she was so beautiful that men would come inside just to see her, and then they couldn't leave without buying tobacco, including New York City newspaper reporters and a writer named Edgar Allan Poe. Well, by July of 1841, Rogers had quit her job at the tobacco shop to help her mother run a boarding house on Nassau Street. And she had a number of admirers there, too, including a sailor named William Keacook, clerk Alfred Crumlin, and the dashingly handsome but hard-drinking Daniel Payne. Well, to her mother's dismay, Rogers chose Payne and accepted his marriage proposal. Though there were rumors the young woman was planning on leaving him. On Sunday, July 25th, Rogers told her fiancé she's going to visit her aunt who lived uptown. She vanished. That Wednesday, her body was pulled out of the river. Well, despite having a number of leads, police couldn't find Rogers' killer. Every suspect they questioned, including fiancé Daniel Payne, had a solid alibi. But events began to take a strange turn. In October of 1841, a few months after Rogers' death, Payne walked into a thicket near Hoboken where Rogers' clothes had been found. And there he wrote a vague note about his misspent life and drank a fatal overdose of laudanum, a liquid form of opium. Then in the fall of 1842, a woman named Frederica Loss lay on her deathbed, the victim of an accidental gunshot wound by her son. While delirious, she confessed on the fateful Sunday, Mary Rogers and the doctor had rented a room in the tavern. Rogers was pregnant, Loss said. She died in the rented room from complications after the doctor performed an abortion. Now, police couldn't find anything to corroborate the confession, but the case did go back into the spotlight. A botched abortion contradicted the coroner's report that Rogers had died of strangulation. Maybe Rogers was planning to leave Daniel Payne after all, and when he found out about that and the abortion, he killed her in a fit of rage. Nobody knew, and nobody ever figured it out. To this day, Mary Rogers' murder remains unsolved, and it was the basis of one of Edgar Allan Poe's early stories, The Mystery of Marie Roget, and helped launch the detective genre of fiction. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We shall be back tomorrow evening when once again, this will be Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a great evening.